Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, thank you so much. Hi, everybody. We welcome you back to Close Up Talk Radio. I'm really excited today because Dr. James Pearl is back with us. He was with us a week ago here in a conversation with Jim Masters. They talked a lot about COVID and other things. He is a top-notch board-certified physician who specializes in pulmonology. Now, you know, I did a little test before we doing this show. I talked to a number of people that I met, and I said I'm going to be interviewing a pulmonologist, and some of them had a question mark on their face. They weren't quite sure what I meant. So I'm going to do something unique. Rather than me telling you all about him, I want him to tell us about him. He's a great interview. He's a great, smart doctor. He's based out in California, in Los Angeles, actually in Irvine, California. And I think you're going to love hearing from him. He does so many different things. But let's bring on Dr. James Pearl from Irvine, California. Newport Beach, really, is where he is. And let me tell you something. If you want to live someplace really gorgeous, Newport Beach is the place to be. Anyway, Dr. Pearl, welcome back. Nice to have you here. And for the benefit of those who had question marks on their faces about a pulmonologist, explain to us, and for those people who are listening all over the country, and I guess they could be listening to us around the world, what a pulmonologist really is. What does a pulmonologist do? How do you answer that?
Well, thanks, Doug, for the question. This question is getting a little bit easier to answer now than it was about 5 years ago. For most of my career, I had to explain to people what a pulmonologist was. People always would say, "What, you deal with the heart?" And I had to explain, "No, we deal with the lungs." And now the last couple of years, because pulmonary doctors and lung doctors have been the doctors taking care of most of the COVID patients, now pulmonologists have been a little more front and center. So I think if you were polling people about who pulmonologists are and what they do, I think it would poll a little higher than a couple of years ago. But anyway, dealing with the lungs involves lots of different things. I guess the main complaint that people have when they see us is shortness of breath. But shortness of breath isn't always from the lungs. It could be from the heart or for other reasons. But if we think it's from the lungs, it could be because of asthma, where people have obstruction in their airways, or COPD when people have emphysema from smoking, or injuries to their lungs from the workplace, or tuberculosis, or pneumonia, bronchitis. And now the last 10 or 15 years, pulmonary doctors are generally the go-to doctors for people who have sleep apnea, who have breathing problems at night. Pulmonary doctors are the busy doctors in the hospital managing people on ventilators, people who need oxygen, people who are being treated in the intensive care unit. So pulmonary doctors have been kind of filling a lot of different roles.
Boy, it's a huge list of things that you treat and you focus on. Let me ask you, when you started in med school, and I'm the son of two doctors, I'm just wondering, why did you pick pulmonology as a specialist? You could have done many, many others. You know, why this?
Well, I think some of it just depends on what you get exposed to. When I was doing my internship, which is in general internal medicine, we get exposed to the different specialties, and it just seemed that the lungs were kind of the center of the world because everybody had to breathe in, take oxygen in to get energy to their tissues. It was the area where many people in the hospital were sick, and the pulmonary doctors just seemed to be at the center of all these medical issues and taking care of sick hospital patients. That always appeals to us as, you know, kind of younger doctors. As we get a little bit older, we start to recognize that there are lots of other avenues of pulmonary disease, like we talked about a little bit, that are equal appealing, but there is sort of a excitement and action early on in being a pulmonary doctor.
So I assume you love it. By the way, I mentioned I'm the son of two doctors. My dad was a GP. Do they still have GPs at doctors, a general practitioner? I mean, you know, he would deliver a baby in the morning and fix somebody's broken arm in the afternoon. But they don't have doctors who do that anymore, do they?
No, but people aren't really – they're really people that aren't really identified as kind of general practice. I think family
right.
practice is recognized as kind of a legitimate specialty in its own right. But doing extra things like delivering babies with the cost of malpractice and the extra stress, I don't think that many that general practitioners want to be involved in doing that primarily.
No, I just wondered if they exist anywhere. But I assume in small towns in America where, you know, there aren't a lot of doctors near, and you may have one or two doctors in a town and a hospital 100 miles away, those guys do end up being general practitioners, don't they? I mean,
in small towns, people do general practice, and sometimes they're augmented by nurse practitioners or physician assistants. That is a way that they're what you might call physician extenders, where they can bring additional skills to people in rural areas, just like you're talking about.
Let's talk about some of the specialties you work on, and then I want to get into your work as a in the legal world, so to speak, as an expert on various subjects and where you testify in court trials. But one of the things, let me ask you one thing: what do you do when somebody comes in and you ask them if they smoke, and they say that yes, they still smoke? That's a sin almost today, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. It's still surprising, but people have to recognize what a terrible addiction cigarette smoking is. Cigarette smoking is more addictive than heroin. It's more addictive than lots of other drugs, and it is really difficult to quit smoking. And when they've done research studies on the success rate of people trying to quit smoking, you know, it's really about 10%. So it is really difficult. So although I am sometimes frustrated by that, I am always sympathetic to the patients that are struggling, and we try to deal with that separately. For example, getting into smoking cessation counseling or hypnosis or support groups. So there are and some drug treatments. So there are ways of approaching that, but sometimes you just have to accept the smoking as a given and you work with it.
And deal with it. The point is, it has so many ramifications that can be really harmful to the human body, and especially in your area of specialty. I'm right on that, correct?
Sure. I mean, early on in my career, when the percentage of people smoking was a lot higher, COPD or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease was probably the dominant disease that we would see. Now that there's been a decrease in smoking, we see a little less COPD and a little more of other diseases that aren't related to smoking, like asthma. But smoking is still it still remains just a terrible addiction. There are studies that suggest that people who smoke shorten their lifespans by about 9 years. That's pretty serious. And there are other studies show that people who stop smoking can benefit from that no matter how late in life they finally stop smoking.
Let me ask you a quick question. If somebody has quit smoking, let's say 25 years before they come to see you about an issue, is smoking still responsible for what they may be coming to see you for, or has that amount of time kind of erased that problem caused by smoking?
No, you know, COPD is caused you know, kind of in great part by smoking, and people start losing lung function, so they have less lung to be able to work with and breathe. Now, when people
right.
stop smoking, maybe they improve a little bit, but the most important thing is that they stop losing lung function as fast as they were. So we see lots of people that still have the leftover from their smoking 20 or 25 years later, and are maybe even dealing with the consequences for the first time at age 50 or 60.
So it can affect them the rest of their life. But still, it's best that they did stop smoking 25 years ago. Could have been much worse.
Much worse, or they might not be alive at all.
There you are. You know, I know your practice includes treating patients with all kinds of pulmonary problems, including COVID, that you were talking about last week a lot. You teach at the University of California at Irvine, training other doctors and consulting on medical legal cases like occupational exposure and malpractice, and running clinical research trials on new medications for pharmaceutical companies. Those are fascinating subjects. Let's talk a little bit about how you have gone about treating victims of asbestos in a shipyard case that you specialized in and worked a lot on. How serious is the asbestos issue now? And talked about that shipyard case, because I guess there was a lot of asbestos in the ships they worked on. Is that right?
That's right. Now, back in the 50s and 60s and maybe even the 70s, asbestos was used as insulating material, and you typically ran into it on ships, in boiler rooms, in engine rooms, and hundreds of workers worked on this insulation, either applying it or removing it. Now, not too much was known about the risks of asbestos back at the time that that these workers were exposed, but over years, people have been starting to develop significant disease from asbestosis or from asbestos, like lung cancer and mesothelioma, which you still see ads on TV about mesothelioma, and fibrosis or scarring of the lungs, and people have died from asbestos-related disease. So this was a group where people were really heavily exposed over long periods of time, over long periods of years, and developed some pretty serious disease. Now, when I was on the faculty in the Department of Medicine at UCLA, I had the opportunity to evaluate a lot of these shipyard workers with exams and x-rays and exercise tests, and I published several papers about my experiences and about my findings. And then lo and behold, I began being contacted by many of the people involved in asbestos cases and asbestos litigation, either plaintiffs who claimed they were injured or companies that were the employers and were defending these cases. And there weren't too many people very knowledgeable in this field. So I began becoming kind of a go-to consultant on cases like these.
That must have been very, very interesting indeed. There's so many subjects that you work on. Asthma is something, and that's an issue that affects lots and lots of people, and it can start at almost any age. What triggers asthma, by the way? Is it you tell me, what causes someone to develop asthma? What's the simple
answer? I think people need to understand what asthma is and how common it is. People estimate that the incidence of asthma in the population is about 5%. That's one person out of 20 with asthma. Now, yep. Asthma is a disease where people get inflammation in the airways, where their airways are, think of them as being swollen and irritable. And when the airways get like that, the muscles around the airways clamp down and make obstruction, and that's why you hear people wheeze when they try to breathe. Lots of things can cause asthma. There's a school of thought that thinks that air pollution is making asthma worse, and it's been shown to be much more common in cities and in children. Some people think that environmental climate change may be contributing. It can be mold exposure, allergies, all kinds of other medical problems. So a lot of the times when we see patients with asthma, we can't exactly figure out what got them to this point, but we just get to treat them with medicines to open up their airways and sort of quiet down that inflammation in the airways.
Wow. It can be very debilitating. We're talking to Dr. James Pearl. He's based in Newport Beach, California. He is a board-certified physician specializing in pulmonology. And one of the things I pointed out when we started, he serves as an expert witness in various legal cases. I'd like to talk to you about that aspect of your practice a little bit. I doubt you, when you were in medical school and starting out in your practice, that's not something you thought you would end up being doing with testifying in a legal dispute. Am I right about that?
No, that was something really I kind of never saw coming. As
I
kind of mentioned before, it kind of stemmed because I was doing work in a hot topic, the field of asbestos, but that kind of morphed into all kinds of other interesting pulmonary cases. There were lots of other exposures that cause disease. For example, we all know about coal workers' pneumoconiosis, or what's commonly called black lung, where people who worked in the coal mines get emphysema or fibrosis or scarring in their lungs from working in the coal mines. And that's been an area where there's been a lot of litigation and a shortage of experts, kind of like the asbestos field. I've seen people with chlorine exposure. We've all been in a swimming pool and noticed how the chlorine irritated their eyes. Well, chlorine can do the same thing to your lungs and cause pneumonia and edema and swelling. And I've had a chance to see numerous people, for example, with exposure to chlorine from industrial exposures or explosions.
Wow.
The most recent topic is mold, where mold exposure in the households is causing people asthma and bronchitis and other respiratory problems.
How does I never thought about going in a swimming pool where you know the chlorine's in the water when you get in the typical pool, that it could cause a problem in your lungs. How much exposure in a swimming pool do you think it takes before you can be affected by that? Is there any specific guideline?
Yeah, it's not the typical exposure that just causes burning your eyes or a kind of nose irritation does not usually cause lung disease. And in a way, because chlorine is so irritating, people know how to avoid chlorine because it irritates the airways. That's the body's way of kind of creating a protective mechanism. So typically when people get chlorine damage to their lungs, it's because they were exposed to so much chlorine that it just overwhelmed their defenses, and just because they recognized that they still couldn't avoid it.
Wow. Let's talk about some of the legal cases that you've been called upon to testify as an expert witness in. Give us an idea of what those cases involved, if you could.
Well, going back early, there are these asbestos cases, coal workers' exposure, people exposed to other types of industrial gases. The last couple of years, because mold has become a really hot topic, as I was starting to talk about, mold grows in households and apartments where there's water damage and the mold, which is a fungus, grows. Mold can make people allergic and cause asthma and bronchitis and breathing problems. So I've been involved in many of those cases. Every once in a while, I get an oddball case of, for example, chest injury, where a guy falls off a bicycle and breaks multiple ribs and his lung function is never the same, or a fellow had an industrial accident and wind up pinned under an industrial garage for a long period of time right on his chest where he was unable to breathe. I had another case where a driver delivering strawberries had dry ice in the car. Then the dry ice released carbon dioxide, and he got carbon dioxide poisoning. So we really never know what's going to come along and what these cases are going to be. Now, Go ahead.
I was going to ask you, is it typical that it's the prosecution, the attorneys for the, you know, the prosecution who are seeking your help, or is it the defense? I know it could be either, but how's it been typically for you?
Well, it kind of goes both ways. You know, I always feel in these cases I'm kind of a straight shooter. So if someone's asking my opinion on a case, I try at the beginning not even to know who's retaining me, because I don't really want to be biased. I always feel that I've got to be able to sleep at night before a deposition or a trial and not have to feel that I've got to contort the facts. So I think in general, I'm retained by defense, but sometimes plaintiffs still either find me on their own or they're represented by attorney. 50-50, 60-40 defense, something like that.
I really ought to point out you've got an excellent website. Your website is pearlpulmonary.com, Pearl, P-E-A-R-L-E, and then pulmonary, P-U-L-M-O-N-A-R-Y, pearlpulmonary.com is how you get in touch with Dr. Pearl. How about when you're being grilled by an attorney? You know, we see it on television all the time. I don't know if it has happened in your case, but have you been forced to testify? Not forced, but have you been called upon to testify in a court case where the attorney from the opposing side is doing his best to try and trip you up and get you confused, or have you not had to deal with that?
No, it's somewhat like you actually see on TV. I mean, trial attorneys are very skilled, and there are techniques that the attorneys can use that can always confuse you or make you feel a little bit entangled. And what I try to do, and maybe because I've now developed a lot of experience in these cases, is I just try not to let the attorney control what I'm saying. I'll just have to go back and backtrack and phrase the things, phrase the issues the way I want to put them, not the way he wants to put them. And sometimes that works and sometimes they don't. But over the years, I think I've learned a little bit about not being manipulated.
I can imagine that, you know, that's not something that a doctor in medical practice actually studies or is typically prepared for. So it's kind of interesting hearing your points there. You know, as I pointed out, you're involved in so many different things. Talk to me, by the way, in the legal issues, how many cases do you get called upon to testify that involve hospital malpractice? Because that's a pretty big area in the legal field, am I right?
It's a big area, but for me, I would say it's maybe a quarter of the cases that I get a chance to see. They're always difficult.
I would imagine they're difficult. And you're testifying sometimes, I guess, against people where you know those who are involved. Could be. Am I right?
Well, generally speaking, if you know the people that are involved, you disqualify yourself from a case. But these are really difficult cases. You know, the lay people call that these malpractice cases, but the legal term is more something like standard of care. You know, doctors are expected to perform at a reasonable standard of care, and that can, you know, kind of run a gamut of quality. Doctors practice lots of different ways. There are lots of different ways of skinning a cat, because just because a doctor doesn't do something the way I would do it does not necessarily mean it's wrong. But sometimes a doctor's care or the hospital's care or the nurse's care or the laboratory's care or the radiologist's care is below what would be an acceptable standard. So the first thing that the doctor looking at a case like this has to do is he has to figure out what the standard are and did they fall below it. But there's more to it than that. then you have to decide if the patient was injured by this standard of care. You know, unfortunately, some people get sick and don't do well and get worse despite the best intentions and the best care from all the doctors and all the hospitals in the world. So it's very difficult to decide if a patient doing badly is because of some specific error that the doctor or everybody else is making. Then the next thing you have to figure out after you've decided that if the patient has been injured or not, is you have to decide what the injury is, how severe it is, did it cost them their life, are they going to be disabled forever, what kinds of medical needs might they need in the future. So you can see that these cases operate on a lot of different planes at a lot of different levels.
Very, very much so. You know, your experience is so complete. You have also served as a hospital chief of staff and the hospital medical director. That's more like an administrative position almost. How do you enjoy doing that aspect of what you've done in the hospital world?
Well, those are two different jobs. Hospital chief of staff is a position where you're elected by the doctors at a hospital to represent their interests, and people serve as a chief of staff for a few years until the next chief of staff is elected, and he represents the doctor's interests, which aren't always the same as the hospital. Lots of doctors, contrary to popular belief, aren't really employed by hospitals but are independent contractors or work for other groups, so their interests may not quite align with the hospital. So the chief of staff represents the doctors in those issues. Now, the hospital medical director is a different job. The medical director is employed by the hospital. The hospital has a lot of different departments and a lot of different areas where care is delivered, like nursing, radiology, laboratory, intensive care unit, regular medical floor, cardiology. So the hospital medical director is the medical doctor who helps guide these different departments toward providing best care. So both of those jobs that I've served at various times kind of help to inform my understandings about hospital medicine.
Well, it's just amazing to hear about all the various kinds of things that you've gotten into your practice. And are you still? I know you have been teaching at the University of California in Irvine, training other doctors. Do you still do that?
Still do that. That's still one of my multiple hats.
And do you encourage young doctors today to go into pulmonology, the field of pulmonology, which you've specialized in? I would assume you do. Am I right?
I do. I think it's still a pretty exciting field, and there are so many options in pulmonology. Pulmonologists can be intensive care doctors. They can do consults in the hospital. They can be hospitalist doctors. They can work in the office and have a practice. They can do sleep medicine like sleep apnea and narcolepsy. They can do research with pharmaceutical companies. They can be consultants for corporations. You can teach in academic medicine. There are just an endless array of opportunities in the field. I've had a chance to dabble in a lot of them.
Well, it just sounds fascinating what you do and what you have done throughout your career. You're to be congratulated, and I'm sure you have actually loved your work. You got into the right field, you know. At what point, and we only have a minute left, at what point in your life did you decide you wanted to be a doctor? How old were you?
I think that happened when I was in college. I'm not sure there was a sense of inevitability about it. My father was a professional, and it didn't seem like there were other choices. It just seemed like the one that was more meaningful, where I could help more people directly, it seemed I could make my biggest contribution as a doctor, not to minimize
the right thing. You did the right thing. There's no question about that. Dr. James Pearl, Newport Beach, California. Doctor, thanks for being with us today. It's It's been great having you with us.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.
That's it, everybody. See you next time. Bye for now.